Hello and happy Election Day. I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Tuesday, Election Day, the 4th of November. We want to remind you that tonight we will be covering the presidential election and all the Senate races and the House races starting at 6 p.m. The Ideas Network stations and streams and WHRM in Wausau will carry live election coverage. NPR's coverage of state and national races will be anchored by Robert Siegel, Michelle Norris, Scott Simon, and Debbie Elliott. And then we, of course, will have Wisconsin Public Radio's coverage of local and state races anchored by Ben Marins and Sean Johnson. We expect that this will go into the early hours of the morning and will be on the air until things are decided. So please listen tonight. And that will start at 6 p.m. Our guest this hour, and what a great day to have him on, is the author of Tippecanoe and Tyler II, Famous Slogans and Catchphrases in American History. In the intro to the book, our guest writes that the founding fathers knew the power of words well before the Declaration of Independence was written. Their words created the possibility of a new nation and turned untrained men with their hunting weapons into a force that endured to defeat the most powerful nation in the world. With their pens and their voices, they stirred themselves and the world. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, and that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Since then, public words have often been shortened into battle cries, into rallying points, and eventually into symbols, symbols of historical moments that have to be remembered if the new nation with its new form of government were to survive external and internal threats. Our guest has put together a list of stirring phrases that have lasted sometimes for a number of centuries, and we'll ask the question, what will survive 30 or 50 years from now? And welcome your calls as well. There are certain words that may stir you, maybe put them up on the refrigerator. I tend to do that every now and then, to put up stirring phrases to get you going from day to day. Jan Van Meter is our guest, former public relations executive, CIA intelligence analyst, English professor, and speechwriter. We'll be welcoming phone calls, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. And if you'd like to send an email, that's talk@WPR.org. Jan, thank you so much for being with us. Happy Election Day.
Same to you, Kathleen, and thank you for having me.
Yeah, we should have some fun today.
I hope so. The lines are already around the blocks outside polling places near here. So,
where are you, Jan?
In Manhattan.
Oh, you're in Manhattan, and they're around the block.
Yeah.
Well, and they've already been 4 or 5 hour wait in some parts of the country, which is way too long.
Yeah.
I think. So you voted.
I think the states that have extended days for taking the vote or being very smart, and I'm hoping New York switches to this eventually.
Right, and then just make sure you have enough people who are helping.
Yes.
So that the lines aren't 4 or 5 hours. I read that and that it still is so stirring all these years later. We hold these truths to be self-evident. Aren't they? Those are some of the most stirring words in our history.
There's no question about it. I think some of it has to do with the kind of education that that at least the upper middle classes got in those days. They could write, and they wrote for oral presentation, and whether it's Tom Paine or Thomas Jefferson or Patrick Henry, you read those aloud, and it makes the hair in the back of your neck go up. It's really wonderful stuff.
Mm-hmm. And would you say, this is probably not fair because there have been stirring words written now, but is there a qualitative difference between those who wrote for public presentation and used the language so beautifully, as other people have certainly during the time, the ages, and the words that are being written now?
I think the answer is yes, but so much depends on the ability of the speaker. It's not that everybody wrote for himself then. Washington had some of his speeches written by other people. Lincoln had help. Certainly FDR had help writing his speeches. But it really has to do with the extent to which people were expected to be able to speak in front of an audience and speak easily and well. We forget that political speeches were a major form of civic entertainment before there was anything electronic available. and in which in times when the stage didn't reach very many cities for theater, speeches were expected to go 1 to 3, 4
Isn't
hours.
Isn't that amazing?
Yeah.
I know.
And people loved it.
Yeah.
And but at the same time, you can hear throwbacks to that. Ronald Reagan was a superb orator.
Yes, he was.
And you can hear it in Barack Obama, who sort of has both the quality of the Southern Baptist African-American church tradition, but also somebody who is schooled in rhetoric and knows how to move an audience. I remember, I'm an old speechwriter, and I remember when Jimmy Carter got elected, and I said, oh my God, the Democrats managed to find the only Southern Baptist who did not know how to give a speech. And because, I mean, he's a very nice man, and he's certainly risen in sort of esteem since his presidency, but he was a terrible speaker. Obama is very different, I think. But I do think the quality of public oratory has gone down because there's relatively little of it anymore.
The words that stay with us for hundreds of years, how is it? Is it partly the moment in history that it helps define that moment in history? Is it because the words are so brilliant? Why is it that something lasts 300 years and something else will last, well, you hear it and it's gone tomorrow?
Yeah, right. The answer is both. The culture, our political, social culture, remembers the things, or it keeps in our memory, or wishes to, those moments in history that each one of those slogans or catchphrases embodies, so that it's a way of teaching the young and the immigrant, who people worried almost as soon as the revolution was over, that those people wouldn't know why the nation had been founded and what people had to go through. So the teaching of American history to the young and to the immigrant was very, very important if we were going to have a sort of cohesive nation. So that there were modes of conduct, self-sacrifice for the nation, perseverance under great difficulties, for example, but also moments of our history that were absolutely critical, so that these are the times that try men's souls. If we didn't keep going, we would become yet another series of colonies again. Remember, the Alamo is an obvious sort of one that is drummed. I taught in Texas for 4 years, and, you know, the memory of the Alamo and the cry are as alive today as it was 150 years ago. So they are both a sort of mnemonic memory device for the history, but they're also a way of conveying lessons, both about what had happened, but also how you are expected to behave as a citizen of the country.
Interesting.
Now, there are a lot of things, most of those things are remembered for that. There are a few which, as far as I can tell, are only remembered because they sound cute. 5440 or fight is an old Anglo-Saxon poetic method of using alliteration. I doubt if many people anymore know what that was about. It was not a major cry at the time. It's about the whole resolution of the northern border of the United States, but it rhymes and it sounds nice. Tippecanoe and Tyler too,
right,
is the same thing. It actually sounds like a song line, an advertising line. And in fact, it was a song line that somebody had written for the election. But I doubt if you could find 5% of people who could tell you who Tippecanoe was, and he didn't last very long as president anyway.
So why do we remember that? And you're right, if we did a survey, I'm sure that everybody's heard it, but nobody knows what it is.
Exactly. But it rhymes and it scans. It's Tippecanoe and Tyler, too.
Oh, yeah. There you go.
For a while, I thought, Yes, We Can might become one of those lines because it's very reminiscent of the old children's story of the little engine that could. But I think we go through communication so rapidly and lose our attention so quickly and become tired of things so quickly that I'm not sure that's going to survive.
Did you, you read the story? That was one of my favorite stories when I was a kid. My mom used to read that to me all the time, The Little Engine That Could.
Absolutely. And it's one of those children's books that sound, that children like because it tells a story, but behind it is a very basic form of civic morality that you, that's important to the United States, that you must keep trying. You can do it.
Mm-hmm. Give us a little more background on the title of the book, The Tippecanoe and Tyler Too.
Well, it was the result of my losing an argument with the publisher, because I wanted it to be something else. But the background for Tippecanoe and Tyler Too, and you're right, it's, everybody knows it, but nobody really knows what it means. There was an important election in 1840 when the Whigs and the Democratic, what was then called by that time called the Democrats, were fighting to see who was going to be able to win the presidency. The Whigs had a sort of tie, had been in power for a while. The country was tired of them. They were worried about whether they were going to be actually able to survive. The Democrats, on the other hand, tried several people and settled on William Henry Harrison, who was a big general. Had Tippecanoe is the name of a battle he had won.
Hmm.
He picked as his vice president, much to the anger of Henry Clay, John Tyler, who had been born in the same county as Clay, who was a major political power. And he was made, the Whig presidential candidate. They didn't adopt any platform because they didn't want to take any positions on any issues. So the Democrats did not meet for 5 months to nominate someone. And the Whigs mobilized, for the first time it had ever been done in the country, massive grassroots support with all the trappings of what would become modern political campaigns. A Baltimore newspaper editorial sneered at Harrison that he would be just as happy if he was sitting on the porch of his log cabin drinking hard cider and enjoying his pension. And the Whigs seized on that as their in. It became the theme of their campaign. So when the Democrats finally met in Baltimore in 1840 to nominate Martin Van Buren, who was the sitting president, whose nickname was Van Ruin because the economy was in such bad shape, there was 75,000 people gathered to watch a huge Whig parade that was said to be 3 miles long. The marchers pulled log cabins on wheels, with cider barrels on their front porches. They rolled massive balls down the street to keep the ball rolling. They roared for speeches they could not possibly hear. And they chanted endless slogans, and one of which was Tippecanoe and Tyler Too.
What a story.
What had happened was, in the previous decade, the states had changed the way the presidents had been elected. That is, the electors to the Electoral College were now almost entirely elected by the voters themselves as opposed to the state legislators. And so the interest in the election was huge because many people were getting to vote for the first time. And whereas in the previous election, I think only 27% of the voters voted, in this election it went up to 60%. And the campaign was dirty, as they always have been. Van Buren was called an aristocrat who sat in the palatial White House eating off gold plates and sipping French wine. And Harrison was homespun Indian fighter, cider-drinking general. Both of the images were entirely fictitious. Both men were American aristocrats who grew up with money and property and famous forebears. But Harrison had been told to say nothing. And there's a great quote I'll read to you, but one of his advisors wrote, "Let him say nothing. Promise nothing. Let no committee, no convention, no town meeting ever extract from him a single word about what he thinks now and will do hereafter. Let the use of pen and ink be wholly forbidden, as if you were a mad poet in bedlam." And instead, they had people speaking for Harrison. And they were all given working-class occupations, and they wore working-class clothing, and they went out on the stump, and they were people like the Buckeye blacksmith and Tom Corwin, the wagon boy, and not the least of which was Honest Abe Lincoln, the rail splitter. It was his first real major public presence. Well, in the event, the Whigs won huge, and it was a landslide. And the Whigs gained control of both the Senate and the House for the first time. But Harrison died a month after his inauguration, and Tyler, popularly called his accidency, became president. And it was really the birth of the modern political campaign.
Yeah. Great story. Let's welcome phone calls. Our guest is the author of Tippecanoe and Tyler II, Famous Slogans and Catchphrases in American History, Jan Van Meter. They're not all political phrases. Many of them are, because elections tend to bring us together, right? And wars tend to bring us together. There are some other phrases in here. Yes, Virginia, there is Santa Claus. Tomorrow is another day. A lot of them are political, but some of them certainly are not. You've got mail, one of them that's from a different world. Our phone number, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. We'll be with you in just a moment. You can send an email as well if you'd like. That's talk@wpr.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. The second of our program today on this Election Day, we speak with the author of Election Day, an American Holiday and American History. Let's go to phone calls now, and we start with John from Wrightstown. Hi, John.
Hello.
Hello.
Okay, I have two, both of them also from the election of 1840, ironically.
Huh.
In the same little ditty that began with Tippecanoe and Tyler II, it read, "We will vote for Tippecanoe and Tyler II, Tippecanoe and Tyler II, and with them we will beat Little Van." And then this is the line that was really quoted, Van is a used-up man.
Yes.
And then on the other side, the Democrats organized a number of political clubs that they call the old Kinderhook Club, mm-hmm. Kinderhook being from New York. And their slogan was, "Down with the Whigs, boys, O.K.," they abbreviated Old Kinderhook. And many historians think that that's how O.K. Entered the English language. So
yeah,
that's my comments. So.
You know, there's one other slogan from 1840 that has never made anyone's hit list, and I think you can tell why when I tell you it. It's Harrison, $2 a day, and roast beef. It just doesn't sting.
No, it sure doesn't. You say, what?
Yeah.
What? Thanks, John. That was a great contribution. Eugene from Viola. Hi, Eugene.
Good morning, Kathleen. Is your guest familiar with the reply that President Kennedy gave on how to prepare for the presidency when he was asked by Fred Blumenthal, the Washington correspondent for Parade magazine in 1962?
No, I don't think so.
Okay, if I could read part of it, please. Fred Blumenthal, Washington correspondent of Parade magazine, asked President Kennedy this question. Somewhere in our land today, there's a high school or college student who will one day be sitting in your chair. If you could now speak to this future president, what advice and guidance would you give him or her? This is the president's answer. If I could go on for the first paragraph, and then I'll get off the line. The first lesson of the presidency is that it is impossible to foretell the precise nature of problems that will confront you or the specific skills and capacity which those problems will demand. It is an office which called upon a man of peace, Lincoln, to become a great leader in a bloody war, which required a profound believer in limiting the scope of the federal government. Jefferson to expand dramatically the powers and reins of that government, which challenged a man dedicated to domestic social reform. Franklin Roosevelt to lead this nation into a deep and irrevocable involvement in world affairs. And when you assume the presidency, you too will face problems, difficulties, crises, and challenges which no one can foresee. Now, it goes on about a page and a half, and it comes out, I got this out of the World Book Encyclopedia, 1960. It's a long situation.
Right.
But,
yeah, thanks very much for the call. Do you include any Kennedy quotes in your book?
Yes, I do have one, although there could have been many. Ich bin ein Berliner, which has, some people have said that he didn't understand German, which is certainly true, and he had been given the line. He knew what he wanted to say, but that the term actually refers, a Berliner in Germany was a kind of pastry, so when he supposedly announced it, the audience laughed. Well, that's not in fact true, and it was sort of a myth that was created by people who really hated Kennedy, and the Berliners certainly knew what he was talking about.
Let's go to Mark next from La Crosse. Hi, Mark.
Hi, how are you doing?
Fine, how are you?
Good. I'm enjoying the program very much, and I was reading a book recently on FDR, and the author's name escapes me. His first name is Gene. I don't recall last name, but very compelling biography, and I want to mention a couple of very famous comments real quick and get the author's take on this. When I was reading the book, it described how FDR responded to the attack on Pearl Harbor, and it was very interesting. He sat down at his desk with his secretary, lit a cigarette, inhaled the cigarette, exhaled, and then just proceeded to spew out the comments about the day in infamy, so on and so forth, which he delivered to Congress the next day. Very famous speech, obviously. Then I think of Lincoln with the Gettysburg Address, which I understand he basically scribbled out the night before on the train ride to Gettysburg. And I want to contrast that with the Declaration of Independence, which I understand Jefferson worked on for with others, of course, but principally Jefferson for about 17 days. And what I'm driving at here is, of all of the work that you've done with these famous quotes, I'm wondering, are the majority of them the result of somebody reacting quickly, almost sort of not an excited utterance, but coming up with these things quickly versus great and deliberate thought given to them, and I'll take my response off here.
All right, thank you.
The answer is it's both. The idea that Lincoln scribbled the Gettysburg Address on a piece of paper on the train is generally now thought to be one of those myths. He actually did work on it and was quite careful as a writer and a superb writer. But, you know, some of the most famous ones are pure reactions. The American general, General McAuliffe, in Bastogne during the Battle of the Bulge, when asked if he would, you know, that it was time to, told he was, it was time to surrender by the Germans, his formal reply was nuts, and that was it. Now, for years, I thought some PR department cleaned that reaction up,
right.
But it turns out actually to be true. He really did say nuts.
Huh.
At the same time, I've always wondered about Neil Armstrong's. This is, you know, one small step for a man, a giant leap for mankind. It smells to me, as someone who spent 20 years in public relations, like
yes,
somebody made that
right.
one up for him.
Right.
It just doesn't sound like, I mean, a more natural reaction would probably be something like, wow.
Yeah. Look at the view.
Exactly.
Right.
But, you know, I think, and Roosevelt was very, very, very careful about his speeches. I mean, Sam Rosenman was one of the people who helped him a lot with his speeches. I think, so I think the answer is, depending on what it is, it's either the product of great thought. But great thought doesn't mean it's going to be bad writing or bad rhetoric, nor does a spontaneous response guarantee you wonderful things to say. So I think it is both, and it just depends.
Mm-hmm. Let's move away from politics for just a moment. Frankly, my dear, I don't
yes.
give a damn, and tomorrow is another day.
Right, my favorite. I use those two, as I use each one of the slogans or catchphrases, not just to explain who said them and where they were said, but also to talk about a major a moment or a development in American culture. And Gone with the Wind is a great way to get into the development of the motion picture as a major mass form of communications. The two catchphrases, frankly, my dear, I don't give a damn, and tomorrow is another day, come from the end of the movie. And I don't know how many people under 30 who've actually seen the movie, but it was an unusual movie for the time. It was 4 hours long. It had an intermission. Nobody knew if an audience would actually sit through a movie that long or go through an intermission. But it was a story cleaned up in terms of its history, but a story about the survival of a people under occupation, and as well as a great love affair between Rhett Butler, played by Clark Gable, and Scarlett O'Hara. And Scarlett is not a very nice person, and only at the end of the movie, when she's been married twice and gotten rid of both husbands, does she realize that she really loves Rhett. And by this time, he's sort of fed up. And he says he's leaving, and she says, "What am I going to do?" And he turns around on the stairs and looks at her and says, "Frankly, my dear, I don't give a damn." The reason I think that's lasted, like most catchphrases, is it encapsulates a spirit or an attitude that continues to move people, that sort of reaction to enormous frustration, often between genders. And her response captures the American eternal optimism that no matter how bad things are, we can keep going.
Mm-hmm.
Because she collapses on the stairs. She can't, you know, and then suddenly she suddenly realized there is something she wants and she can live for. And it's Tara the plantation. And she says, "Tomorrow is another day." And you fade slowly with a silhouette of Scarlett O'Hara in the background as the plantation. And I swear that the time, there must not have been a dry eye in the whole house. The movie was banned in Europe by the Nazis. They did not want people watching the movie about the triumph of people who were under occupation. And it was a major hit in England, and it was screened continuously throughout the whole war in England.
Let's go to Jane next. Hi, Jane. You're on the air.
Hello.
Hi.
My comment has to do with the fact that many of the people that we were discussing in the earlier portion of the program with politics had a great and deep education in classic languages, Latin and Greek.
Mm-hmm.
And I have noticed watching Obama, he's employed many of the Ciceronian devices for oratory, and to great effect.
Yes.
And I'm positing the fact that, you know, our general school kids these days are not educated in Latin. Latin not only teaches you to have a good vocabulary, but it teaches you to write English in a way that if you've had to read, like, Caesar's, you know, Conquests of Gaul, it gives you a cadence, a way of organizing sentences, a way of putting things together. And Latin politics was filled with slogans and jingos.
Yes, it was. You're absolutely right. Obama himself, I mean, I've read the Dreams of My Fathers, and that was written long before he ever thought of being in politics, and it is gorgeously written. The man can write. I suspect he's also got a very good speechwriter. But Latin is making a comeback in New York City. Latin is being often taught in many of the public schools. My son had 4 years of it. Kids are taking it, but I agree with you. It's a combination of knowing the classics, knowing the King James version of the Bible, which is gorgeous literature, and then doing as much writing as you can.
Mm. Thank you, Jane, so much for your call. Here's a fun one from a listener email. Do you have gold water in 64, hot water in 65, bread and water in 66? I remember this from grade school. I don't remember that one. That's a good one, huh?
I had forgotten that entirely. That's great.
Yeah. We have some lines open now if you want to join us. It's 800-486-8655. Victoria from Appleton is next. Hi, Victoria.
Hi, Kathleen.
Hi.
This is a fun program on Election Day. I just wonder if the guest knows if, I think it was during the debate between Dukakis and George Bush Sr., did George Bush Sr. really say, uh-uh, not going to go there and stay the course? Or was that just parody that Saturday Night Live did?
I think it was parody.
Okay, and
I mean he's famous in that. He's famous in that debate for kept checking his watch. He was so bored.
Yeah, because I think Dana Carvey, who imitated or impersonated George Sr., did say that he's the one that thought of stay the course and not going to go there. So George Sr. isn't, attributed to that. But the other thing I'm thinking of is for a movie, I think a modern-day movie that has two catchphrases within the same movie is Jerry Maguire, You Had Me at Hello and You Complete Me. I think those are two phrases that I think will kind of hold up just as well as... frankly, my dear, I don't give a damn. Just something modern that's out there
okay.
for the younger generation. So thank you for taking my call.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thanks for
Bye-bye.
The call. We're talking this hour with the author of Tippecanoe and Tyler II, and the subtitle is Famous Slogans and Catchphrases in American History. Jan Van Meter is our guest. Jan is a former public relations executive, a CIA intelligence analyst, an English professor, and a speechwriter. How's that for a variety of talents and careers? We're talking about famous slogans and why some last for a long period of time. The number that come from politics. I'll ask him why so many come from the world of politics, from elections and speeches during momentous times in American history, and there are others. We'll take more of your phone calls momentarily. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Just a reminder that we will be providing wonderful election coverage this evening, starting at 6 o'clock. The Ideas Network stations and streams and WHRM in Wausau will carry live election coverage. NPR's coverage of national races will be covered, anchored by Robert Siegel, Michelle Norris, Scott Simon, and Debbie Elliott. And then, of course, we'll have Wisconsin Public Radio's coverage of local and state races, anchored by Ben Marins and Sean Johnson. That should go all night, not all night long, but they're saying that it could go as late as 2 in the morning. So stay with us. If you're on the road, if you'd like to listen on radio, we do superb election coverage, and that will be starting at 6 tonight here on the Ideas Network. Jan Van Meter is our guest now. His book is Tippecanoe and Tyler II, Famous Slogans and Catchphrases in American History. And we're welcoming your calls on this election day, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Why, Jan, is a line, and you hear it repeated so often by pundits, actually, on various television shows, it's the economy stupid. It doesn't ring as being particularly poetic, but why do we remember that line?
It's an interesting question. It's not only particularly poetic, it's also insulting. I suspect it has something to do with its adaptability to a lot of other uses, because it's often changed to its entertainment. It's the entertainment stupid, or it's the, you know, it's the tanks stupid. And it's the more verbal equivalent of duh, which my son used to use all the time. And I think it lasts because of its adaptability and its sort of reflection of somebody's frustration with people who don't understand the obvious. And beyond that, I really couldn't say.
That's a good explanation. Let's go to Patricia from Osseo. Hi, Patricia.
Hi. I'm calling to ask about whether or not any of your guests' catchphrases reach more cross-culturally to other racial or cultural communities, more specifically to American Indian speeches or catchphrases that he might know of, because American Indian people are wonderful speakers and their entire history is based on an oral history. And then my other question is if he has ever heard of the catchphrase from one of the Minnesota's governors in response to starving Dakota people when he said, "Let them eat grass," which is comparable to Marie Antoinette's "Let them eat cake." So I was just wondering about any darker catchphrases that aren't so nationalistic. And yeah, I guess I'll take my response.
All right, Patricia. Thanks. Thanks for the call.
Well, the answer to your first question is this book is really written to talk what a friend of mine says that you're describing is the American religion, and to some extent I think he's probably correct. There are slogans that come out of or refer to women's liberation movement. One, which ironically is an ad slogan, "You've come a long way, baby."
For a cigarette, isn't it?
Yes, it is. For Virginia Slims.
Hmm.
And there are several that come out of civil rights and the African-American tradition. The book doesn't go further, partly because I was told, okay, you got this many words you can write, and then you get to stop. And so there's a lot left out, both good and bad. Now, I didn't leave out some of the worst ones, if you will. I think I mentioned in the introduction, the one most enduring is the only good X, and put in whatever you want there, is a dead X, which changes its ethnic or racial component depending on who's talking and when. But that has survived, and I suspect not only in our own culture. But no, I have not tried to be encyclopedic, and I don't think my publisher was particularly interested in my being encyclopedic. The second one, let me see. What was you asked if there were any negative ones?
Yes, any dark ones.
Well, that's certainly one of them. Burn, baby, burn is certainly one. That came out of the Los Angeles riots in 1965, and ironically was the slogan of a disc jockey with the marvelous name of Magnificent Montague, who was in Los Angeles at the time. He was very popular on the East Coast, went out there, and he used to, when somebody was playing great music or singing particularly well, he would yell, "Burn, baby, burn," and woke up one morning to the live broadcast of the Watts riots, hearing people chant, "Burn, baby, burn," and he was aghast, but it became iconic to that moment.
Thanks very much for the call. Let's go to Bob from Waukesha next. Hi, Bob.
Hello. Thank you for taking the call. I just wanted to say that, throughout the decades, literally, I go back quite a number of years, being over 50 years old, that there's been a great deal of satire at every level directed towards every age. And I remember when I was 14 years old in 1968, going in 1969, when we had the presidential elections, and Mad Magazine gave an issue that had a bunch of political stickers on the inside, And one of them that to this day I remember and it just makes me laugh was that Richard Nixon, he was the one in 64. He'll be an even bigger one in 68.
Oh, no!
and that's a magazine, of course. At that time, it was cheap at 35 cents. Today, it's like a couple of dollars for an issue. But the satire that exists in Saturday Night Live, the satire that exists in all of the media, has played such a big role in elections. I remember reading very old publications of political cartoons done even at the time of some of our forefathers. So I'll take any other comments offline.
Thanks, Bob. Thanks for your call.
No one has seriously talked about the influence of humor increasingly on elections. And I suspect things like The Daily Show have been powerful forces in this election. On the other hand, Chevy Chase destroyed President Ford. If you remember Chevy Chase,
he would fumble
back.
And, yeah, right.
And, I mean, it must have been horrible to be portrayed as a total bumbler every week.
Right. And who was the, was it Bob Schieffer who told this story a few weeks ago when he was on the air that actually he was the one who got that story going, I guess, and then he felt terribly about it, and he wound up hitting his head and knocking himself out on an airplane. Bob did, that is, when he was covering Gerald Ford, so he got his, right? That he actually was a very fine athlete and quite coordinated.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
Right. He could, what was the line about him? He couldn't walk and chew gum at the same time?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Or he had played too much football without his helmet.
Yes, right, right. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. We have some lines open, 800-486-8655. This one has lasted a long time and has been used by presidential candidates and a number of people who are describing the country. John Winthrop's, "We shall be as a city upon a hill." What was the context of that?
That, to me, is one of the more interesting ones in some ways. It's one of the ones I did not grow up with. But in 1630, Winthrop came over with the first group of pilgrims to found what became Boston and settle here. And Winthrop was elected. They had annual elections. He was selected as their governor of the Massachusetts Bay Colony, which and was subsequently elected many times. But on the way over, he gave a sermon. And everybody was coming over, as I say, not for religious liberty for everybody, but religious liberty for themselves. And anybody who wanted their own religion had to go someplace else. But they were fleeing what amounted to persecution in England. They were positive that the Lord was going to do terrible things to the English for the way they had were worshiping God with a false religion, and they would preserve the true religion in the New World until such a time as England was humbled and they could go back and teach everybody the real way of worshiping the Christian God. And so he gave a speech, or a sermon, rather, on the ship called A Model of Christian Charity, in which he said that we must live up to our obligations to each other and to our God, because we will be as a city upon a hill, and the eyes of the world will be upon us. And if we fail in our society, we will be made a mockery of, and we will be despised. But if we live up to it, we can be the symbol for everybody on how to behave. It was forgotten by everybody except sort of religious scholars and early American historians, and really disappeared from our culture as a slogan. And I've seen early histories of this, of the Massachusetts Bay Company, written in the 19th, early 20th century. And while the sermon is talked about, the line is not discussed. The first time it reappears is just before John F. Kennedy's inauguration for president, he gave a speech to the what's called the General Court of the Commonwealth of Massachusetts. It's the combined legislatures. And he uses that quote, and he talks about how we have to be the kind of government which will everyone will want to emulate by the way we treat our people and we treat everybody else. Then wasn't really noticed, except in Massachusetts. It was Ronald Reagan who brought John Winthrop back and his line back because he fell in love with the idea that John Winthrop was and his fellows were the first freedom men. They've come to the United they've come to America for freedom. And that we would be, as Reagan changed the line, we would be as a shining city upon a hill. And that everybody would take our way as the best way of living. And it's if you ask most people today, they will tell you that it's Ronald Reagan's line.
Mm-hmm.
And he used it a number of times. But it was a very different meaning than it was originally for John Winthrop himself.
Hmm. Let's go to Ben from Wausau next. Hi, Ben.
How are you?
All right. How are you?
Good.
Good.
I just had some information that I thought you might find interesting. I did find it interesting. Political slogans that have endured to this time. In the election of 1836, Martin Van Buren's nickname was Old Kinderhook, and he went by his initials, OK, and that's how we got that slogan.
Right, yeah, we touched on that a little bit earlier. That's interesting. That would be fun to do a book on just that, the phrases that mean something different that came from political slogans, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. Thanks, Ben, for the call. John is next from Webster. Hi, John.
Good morning.
Hi.
Good morning. I'm calling. I'm thinking that a lot of catchphrases have to do with personality clashes, and specifically, I'm talking about the problems that existed between Harry Truman and General Douglas MacArthur. And MacArthur, of course, is so well known for his speech as he retired when he said, "Old soldiers never die; they just fade away." And if you think back into what was going on, I think the war in the Pacific there had to take a back seat to the feud that was going on between Harry Truman and Doug MacArthur. And frequently, Doug MacArthur would make disparaging remarks about Harry Truman, and Harry Truman's response was, you know, you can say anything that you want about Harry Truman, but you can't talk about the President of the United States that way. And I'm reminded, of course, also of another famous quote by Harry Truman when he says, the buck stops here.
Sure, that's in the book. That's a famous one, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, John, so much for your call. So what do you think of those you talked about, yes, we can, probably not surviving? What are the recent quotes that you think will be around 300 years from now?
300 years from now. Right. I just hope we're around. In some ways, mission accomplished could survive as a sort of an argument against hubris, against being too quick to declare victory. It is ironic and, if you will, negative in that sense. Make my day, possibly. Read my lips. No new taxes is another.
Mm-hmm.
The difficulty, I think, is the internet is not a form of mass communications, but a mass form of communications. It splits its audiences and eats up material with voracious speed. And it's hard to know what can endure in that sense. I used to think that You've Got Mail will endure. On the other hand, that's only for AOL, and AOL is shrinking rapidly.
John Tretterer, on-air producer, reminds me of I Have a Dream, which I think, you know, if we are still around,
oh,
that
I
will all remain.
there's no question. I have a dream, which is in the book.
Mm-hmm.
If there is one that is going to survive, it will be that, because it epitomizes the American belief that anything is possible as long as you remain optimistic and continue to fight,
right.
which is shot through American history with that. Even in baseball, wait till next year for the Brooklyn Dodgers is the same
right,
idea.
Right, yeah. Jan, thank you so much for being with us and for writing such an informative and entertaining book.
Well, thank you, Kathleen. I appreciate it. I had a nice time.
Good, good. We did too. Jan Van Meter, the book is Tippy Canoe and Tyler Too, Famous Slogans and Catchphrases in American History. Jan is a former public relations executive, CIA analyst, and English professor and speechwriter. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing this hour and to John Treader for on-air production. On this election day, we want to remind you that we will be carrying National Public Radio's coverage of state and national races, anchored by Robert Siegel, Michelle Norris, Scott Simon, and Debbie Elliott. And we'll also have Wisconsin Public Radio coverage of local and state races. And all of that starts at 6 tonight on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.